Welcome, everyone, to a special Speakeasy podcast. In fact, this is a special Vino and Veritas edition of the Speakeasy podcast. My name is Dr. Tom Krenwitter. I am president of Speakeasy Ideas. Of course, you can find all things Speakeasy at our website, speakeasyideas.com. By the way, if you're not getting our newsletter, I highly recommend that you sign up. It's free, and we always keep your information confidential, and it takes all of about 2.5 to 3 seconds to do it. I mean, literally, you just put in your email address, hit subscribe, and you're ready to go. So what we're going to do today in this podcast, this sort of unusual special version, this is for those of you who were either not in attendance this past Monday. We had our first Vino and Veritas meeting on Monday. What was that date? January 28th. And so for those of you who were not there, but you're planning on coming in February and or future meetings, this is a way to sort of catch you up. I'm going to summarize in this podcast what we did Monday evening. And it's also for those of you who were there and, you know, maybe you were sitting in the back of the room snoozing a little bit, or you missed something and you just wanted a little summary, a little, kind of remind yourself of some of the main highlights of our discussion Monday night. This will be helpful for you as well. So let me begin this podcast just like I began Monday evening. By the way, I should mention, for those of you who were not there, you should have been. Sorry, I don't mean to rub it in, but I kind of do. It was a load of fun. I mean, it was a hoot. My plan was to start at about 6 o'clock, and I walked in, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 minutes before that, and the room was packed. There was not an empty chair, and even more importantly, what I saw, I looked around the room, I saw a lot of new faces, I saw some people I knew, I saw a lot of people I didn't know, and I saw people who didn't know each other sitting at tables, enjoying the great wine, and eating, and talking, and laughing, and it was just a perfect, wonderful way to kick off our new club, the Vino and Veritas Club. And in that light, I want to thank our business partners. This really is it's a very unique kind of venture. I don't know of anything like this going on today anywhere here in Colorado or anywhere else in the United States. A group of people who get together in the evening and sip great wine and make new friends and eat some good food and read through and discuss the Federalist Papers together. And it's really possible only because three businesses have teamed up. My business, Speakeasy Ideas, the whole team here at Speakeasy Ideas, along with the AmeriChicks with Kim Munson. She's been out there promoting this on the radio, helping us to find sponsors. She's just been doing a really bang-up job. You can find her on KLZ. You can also check out her website, the AmeriChicks. And I'm going to encourage all of you, by the way, who are looking for opportunities to advertise your business or your organization through the radio, you want to contact Kim Munson because she's incredibly well-connected. She has a very dynamic network of loyal followers and people who keep up with her work and participate. And it's one of the reasons we chose to team up with her for Vino and Veritas. And also, it wouldn't have been possible without Jennifer and Chad Hewlin, who are the proprietors at Water's Edge Winery and Bistro. That's where it happened, right there in their winery. And it was fantastic. I mean, you know, I was worried at first when we very first started talking about this idea of doing something like this. And I thought, my goodness, I don't want this to feel like some, you know, dry, sterile college classroom, you know, seminar sort of thing. Well, we solved that problem by going to Water's Edge Winery and Bistro. I mean, it's beautiful in there. It's absolutely gorgeous. They have fantastic wine. You know what they did? The owners, Jennifer and Chad Hewlin, they did their homework. They have figured out the world of wine. And of course, here we are in Denver, Colorado, right? So what they did is they went around, not just around the United States, but around the world, looking at grapes, checking out grapes. And they have select grapes imported here to Denver, and then they make the wine. They go through that whole process of fermenting the wine right there at Water's Edge Winery and Bistro. In fact, they have a big room there with these great big containers. You can see the wine as it's in the process of being made. It's fantastic. And so I want to thank them for providing that beautiful facility. It was absolutely the perfect place to host the first meeting of the Vino and Veritas Club. Also, a quick shout out to Rafe and Twee Patton of Harmony Ridge Construction. Harmony Ridge Construction was the sponsor for this first meeting. For those of you who were not there, you missed. We had a big placard right up above in the front of the room there. And they helped to make this possible. And if any of you are looking for opportunities to sponsor one of our Vino and Veritas Club meetings, please let us know. You can send an email to Bethany@speakeasyideas.com or just hop onto our website there, click the little contact button and get a note to us. This first one was sponsored by Harmony Ridge Construction. And what they do, it's a residential construction business based here in the Denver area. I mean, I think they'll venture out, you know, a little bit. They'll get into adjoining counties. And what they're really good at are projects like remodeling. You want to remodel your kitchen. You want to remodel your bathroom. You want to rebuild a whole section of your house. You want to take a little area of either that's next to your house or maybe out in the backyard and transform that into a gorgeous, entertaining area. An area for entertainment. I mean, they'll come out there and they'll build patios and they'll build in, you know, cooking facilities. You can have an oven right there in your backyard. Those are the kinds of things they're really good at, up to, all the way, and including you buy a parcel of land and you want to build a house from scratch. They're the ones you're going to want to talk to. It's Harmony Ridge Construction. You can find them on the internet at harmonyridgeconstruction.com, all one word. All right, now let's get down here to the recap of what we did Monday evening at the first meeting of Vino and Veritas. Of course, the primary subject throughout the year, we are going to spend 12 months, an entire year, working our way through the Federalist Papers. And this first night was mainly talking about the Federalist Papers, its background, the people who were involved in writing it. I offered some comments about the structure of the book and some tips for going about reading it. And so we didn't actually dig into the text of the book. We're going to do that next month in February. Will be the first time that we actually dig into the text. And I will go ahead and say right now here in this podcast that what I would like everyone to do who's going to come in February is to read ahead of time the Federalist Papers numbers 1 through 8. That is number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. You don't need to go into number 9. 9 really starts a new little subsection. So we're going to save that for the March class. But we're going to try to talk about those first 8 papers in the February class meeting. So of course, this raises a big question. I mean, an obvious question. Why? Right? Why do this? Why? You remember the old quip by Mark Twain? I think it was Mark Twain who said that someone asked him what golf is, and he said, a perfect way to ruin a perfectly fine walk. You could say the same thing about Vino and Veritas, right? I mean, why ruin an evening with great wine and wonderful food with the Federalist Papers, with a discussion of the Federalist Papers? Well, The Federalist Papers are a number of things. It is a distinctly American contribution to political science, to the formal academic scholarly study of politics. That's one reason. Another reason is it is both an advertisement for and an explanation of the United States Constitution. And I'll talk a little more here about that in just a little bit. But of course, that is the focus. That's the main focus. It is a book written with a purpose. There's an action item behind writing the book. The action item is Hamilton, the main mind who thought up of the Federalist Papers. He wanted to persuade Americans to ratify the proposed Constitution that came out of the convention of 1787. So, of course, that's the topic, the Constitution. And if someone asked the question, well, okay, so why spend 12 months of getting together with friends and drinking wine and eating great food and talking about a book that really revolves around the United States Constitution? And I would say this about the United States Constitution. You know, if you think through all of human history, all of recorded human history, thousands of constitutions have been written, adopted, and then later abandoned at various times and under various circumstances. I mean, think of that. Thousands of them. Thousands of constitutions. And among all those many countless thousands of constitutions, only one in all of history has lasted 250 years. Ours, the United States Constitution. I mean, that's sort of a remarkable thing, isn't it? Look around the world right now today, and there's only one constitution that has been in effect. I mean, it has been altered, granted, it's been amended and changed in the way it's interpreted. But regardless, you cannot point to any other nation on earth right now that has a constitution that is anywhere as durable, that has remained in effect for anywhere close to the amount of time that the United States Constitution has. So I would say, in response to you, if you ask why spend time talking about the Constitution, I would say this. Look, if you knew nothing else about the United States Constitution other than that fact that it has stuck around, it has been useful, it has been used, it's been authoritative for a much longer period than any other constitution in all of history. That alone makes the Constitution rather interesting, does it not? I mean, it seems that there's something there. There's something unique in the United States Constitution. This is not to say that it's perfect. I don't think the Constitution is perfect. There's some criticisms I have of the Constitution, and I'll be voicing those criticisms as we go along in our study of the Federalist Papers. But that's a distraction. The big point is, look how long this thing has endured. That's quite remarkable. And so that alone is sufficient reason, I believe, to get to know it. We should know about our Constitution. After all, it is our Constitution, right? It's a Constitution for we the people of the United States. The Constitution is not for lawyers or judges or scholars of, in classrooms who study this. It's for we the people. And we are citizens. We want to know about our Constitution. That's part of the reason we're focusing on the Federalist Papers for this first inaugural year of Vino in Veritas. I want to say another word about the Constitution, and I mentioned this Monday night from up on the stage there, and that is, when we think about the Constitution, and some of you in the audience, some of you listening right now, I suspect some of you have thought long and hard and deep about the Constitution, and some of you have thought very little about it. And, you know, that's okay. Hey, life's busy, right? It's hard to pay attention to everything. I get it. And for those who have given some thought to the Constitution, it's really easy, it's really tempting to be critical, you know, to say, well, this part of the Constitution isn't right, or that part could have been better, or, you know, whatever the case is. And I want to remind us as students, as learners, as readers, as curious minds who want to know more, that, yeah, sure, you know, it's possible that a truly wise mind, a really talented, thoughtful, prudential, wise, learned mind might be able to sit down and write a constitution superior to the United States Constitution of 1787. I in no way doubt that. It is probably possible. Some of you right now in the audience, right now, there are some really smart people listening to this podcast right now. Some of you perhaps could write a constitution that is better designed, better structured, less ambiguous, less vague, more clear, more effective at what its purposes are than the Constitution of 1787. However, remember this. It's not merely a matter of, is there a better constitution possible? I mean, of course it is. Look, the Constitution, let's be really clear about this. It's a human-made document, right? A group of guys, a group of dudes getting together in Philadelphia in 1787, they wrote this Constitution. And while there were some, you know, there were some pretty bright, pretty sharp members of the Constitutional Convention, not everybody was. And all of them in that room, they were human beings. They were nothing more than human beings. They were not angels. They weren't gods. They were nothing like that. They're just people. They're just human beings. And so any constitution that they put together, that they designed, that they wrote, you know, of course it could be better. Someone else possibly could do something better. Here's the point I want to make. One of the challenges of the Constitution was not merely that it be good, but that it be approved by a majority in the Constitutional Convention, right? So think about that. Think if you were to sit down and write a constitution, and suppose you wrote it all out by yourself, and it's a work of art. It's perfect. Every little part, right, lines up with the other parts, and it makes just a perfect whole, and it forms the perfect, best kind of government. It's just great. It is spectacular. And then you got to walk that thing into the convention. You're part of the Constitutional Convention. At one point, there's 55 delegates there. And say, hey, will you guys vote to support this? And immediately what's going to happen? Somebody's going to say, well, I'll vote for that if you make this change, and if you add this, and if you subtract that, right? You see what starts to happen. As soon as you subject your beautifully written, perfectly designed constitution to a committee, some of those other members on the committee are going to want to influence what's in the constitution you wrote. And from the Constitutional Convention, it then went to be ratified by millions of people spread out among 13 different states. So when we think about the Constitution, the question, don't compare it to perfection. Don't have in your mind some abstract idea of a perfect Constitution and then say, well, right, be critical and say the U.S. Constitution is less than the perfect. It's less than the ideal constitution. Yeah, of course it is. Yes. Rather, judge it against that standard. Is it something that is pretty good, pretty wise, and capable of being approved by a large committee and then later ratified by millions of people? And when you think about those requirements, and then look at that constitution, all of a sudden it sort of takes on a different light, doesn't it? All of a sudden you start thinking, it's pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty good. Considering that, you know, all the people that had to sign off on it and approve it and ratify it, and we got that thing through that whole process, it's pretty good. it's hard to imagine a constitution that would be much better and be able to be ratified by, you know, initially 9 of the states, eventually all 13. According to the Constitution itself, in Article 7, it states that the, remember, this was the second Constitution, right? The Americans had a Constitution. It was called the Articles of Confederation. And it, all 13 states had signed off. That was their national constitution. So this was Constitution number 2 that came out of the Philadelphia Convention. And it was this very curious thing. And in fact, this is going to be a fun part to talk about in the Federalist Papers, because the Federalist Papers addresses this problem. The Constitution, the proposed Constitution of 1787, it stated in Article 7 that it would become effective as soon as 9 states ratified it, among and between those 9 states only. And so, of course, that leaves this really curious question. Well, there were 13 states initially, and what would have happened if 9 had ratified it and the other 4 had not? What if the other 4 had just said, hey, you know, we've already pledged our allegiance to the original Constitution, and we're not backing out on that. We're sticking to our word. Imagine how they could have defended their choice. They could say, look, we're staying loyal to the Constitution that we signed on to. You other 9 states, you're being traitors to the Articles of Confederation, right? That wasn't signing off or adopting some new Constitution. That wasn't part of the deal when we agreed to the Articles of Confederation. And that was a question. That was a potential problem. It's going to be very interesting to see how the Federalist Papers presents that. Hamilton and Madison are sort of tap dancing around that subject in a way. And we will get to that. And so, you know, that's what this is all about, ultimately, is the Federalist Papers is an attempt to persuade Americans to adopt this proposed Constitution. And more than that, it is also an attempt to train Americans how to think like constitutionalists. In the process of explaining what this Constitution is, and you're justifying, making the arguments why there are these various features, why certain powers are granted to government, why many powers are not granted to government, and how to think about that. It's the Federalist Papers is sort of an exercise in thought, in training citizens how to think like self-governing constitutionalists. So it's a piece of advertising, it's a piece of marketing, and it's an attempt to influence the character, the attitude, the thought processes of citizens. And as we'll mention this next week in Hamilton's introduction that he writes, that stands as kind of a preface to the whole project. It's also an attempt to discover the true interests of the American people, to discover the truth, to talk to the truth. So it's this very curious work, the Federalist Papers, in that it is a piece of marketing and advertising, and it's also a philosophic treatise. It's an exercise in philosophic exploration and investigation at the same time. All right, so we had the convention, right? The Constitutional Convention in the summer of 1787. We know when the convention wrapped up, among many reasons, one of which is the Constitution itself tells us in Article 7 of the Constitution. It dates the conclusion of the work of the convention. And, you know, that dating of the Constitution is a very curious thing. Because it dates, the Constitution dates itself in two ways. It dates itself according to the year of our Lord, which of course is a very common way of dating things then. The Constitution says that it was done in convention by the unanimous consent of the states present the 17th day of September in the year of our Lord, 1787. So that's September 17th, 1787. That's why September 17th is Constitution Day. It's the day that the Constitutional Convention wrapped up its work. It's why every September 17th, right, you have all kinds of parties and barbecues because you're celebrating Constitution Day. It's why our friends up in Grand Lake, Colorado, for those of you who don't know this, I want to tell you about something really cool. This is a little bit of a detour, but I'll get right back on track. The good people of Grand Lake, Colorado, which is it's a small town that sits on the edge of what I believe is the deepest mountain lake, certainly in the Rocky Mountain, that whole Rocky Mountain region, perhaps in the world. I'm not sure about that. But it's a very deep, gorgeous lake way up in the mountains, and the town is called Grand Lake. And they not only put on, they not only celebrate Constitution Day. Oh, they do better than that. They have a Constitution Week. I am kidding you not at all. Every year, Grand Lake, Colorado hosts a Constitution Week. For an entire week, they do all kinds of things. They have races, they have parades, they have barbecues, they bring in speakers, sometimes some really good ones like Tom Kranewitter from Speakeasy Ideas. I'm just being a little facetious there. I do go up there and speak, and it's a great event. But they have all kinds of constitutional scholars, historians, judges, those types of people to talk about the Constitution, and you should check that out. And that Constitution Week always revolves around September 17th. It either, you know, begins on the 17th or it's a few days before and after. It includes September 17th because that's when the Constitutional Convention finished up its work. And Article 7 that I was just reading from, it goes on and offers another way of dating the Constitution. It says, and of the independence of the United States of America, the 12th. Isn't that a curious thing? So if you're in September of 1787, the Constitution says you are also into the 12th year of independence. Well, if you count backward then, when did independence start? You end up at 1776. Can you remember a famous document from 1776? Ah, yes, that's right, the Declaration of Independence. So right there, in the final line of the Constitution, it is pointing toward the connection between the Constitution itself and the Declaration of Independence, the Declaration of 1776. So, okay, the convention wraps up, and there it is. It's September in 1787, and as of that moment, the Constitution was nothing but a written piece of paper. It's just a piece of paper with some ink on it. That's it. It had no binding meaning. It had no legal authority. It was meaningless from a, you know, legal point of view, from a constitutional point of view. What had to happen? It needed to be ratified by at least 9 states. And of course, their hope was that it would be ratified by all 13, and eventually it was. But when the convention was finished, the Constitution initially had been ratified by 0, nobody, no states. And that is when, Hamilton jumped into action. And he came up with the idea of a series of newspaper articles that would both explain the Constitution and attempt to persuade Americans to adopt it. And it's worth mentioning here, this interesting period during the American founding with regard to constitution writing. As I've already mentioned, right, the proposed constitution that came out of the Constitutional Convention, that was Constitution number 2. That was National Constitution number 2 for the Americans. They already had one, the Articles of Confederation. And what was going on in the states in the course of the Revolutionary War, as the Americans had declared independence from the British Empire? What became 13 states? What were those before they were states? They were all colonies, right? They were 13 colonies that were part of and effectively belonged to the British Empire. And as each of those colonies became independent and became states, they too were writing constitutions. In fact, several states went through 2 and even 3 constitutions within, you know, within a decade or so. And so my point is, in this very short period of time, in the late 1770s and the 1780s, in North America, there is this wave of constitution writing going on. And which makes it a very curious thing. I don't know of any period in history where there is so much open public discussion and debate and conversation about features of constitutional design. I mean, it's a really strange thing when you think about it, right? This is not the sort of thing that ordinary people talk about ordinarily. They're not talking about design features of various kinds of constitutions. But these Americans in the 1770s and the 1780s, they were in fact talking about various, you know, virtues, strengths, pros, cons of different kinds of constitutional designs. And to help that, to facilitate that, two of our authors of the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, who wrote almost all of them, both of them did the same thing in preparation for the convention. They both collected as many books as they could find on the history of constitutions. So anything they could put their hands on about ancient Greek constitutions, Roman constitutions, medieval European constitutions. They wanted to know as much as they could about what has been tried. How have prior constitutions been designed? What kind of incentives did they create or disincentives, right? How did these things work out over time? And so they really sat and studied that history of constitutions so that they could come to the Constitutional Convention as well informed as possible about what has been tried, what has worked, what is not, and what kind of incentives to expect from various constitutional design features. So this project that Hamilton dreams up, it's a project of newspaper essays. Why newspaper essays? Well, newspapers, it's hard for us today to really understand. I mean, here you are. You're listening to me on a podcast, right? And we sort of take that for granted. Well, there were no podcasts in 1787. In fact, there was no internet. There was no radio. There was no TV. There really was no. I'm going to make a big sweeping statement here, and it's true. There was nothing. The way we would describe popular culture today, if someone asked you to define what is popular culture, all those things that you would include as popular culture, movies, right, websites, magazines, radio, TV, all those kinds of things together, that didn't exist. There was no popular culture in 1787. And, I mean, honestly, the two main socializing or social features in 1787 were religion and politics. I mean, those are the big things. You went to church, not only to worship, but you also went to church to see your friends and to socialize and to, you know, hear about news and find out what's going on in the world. And really the same thing about politics. I mean, if a politician was going to give a public speech or something like that, that was a way to go and learn about what was going on in the world beyond your property line, beyond your home or your business. And one of the main ways that people communicated, disseminated information, was through newspapers. Newspapers and pamphlets. They were hugely popular, hugely influential. It's hard to overstate or exaggerate just how influential newspapers and pamphlets were. And that's why Madison thought, let's do a series of newspaper essays to persuade people to adopt the Constitution, to ratify it. And of course, Hamilton is in New York. He lives in New York. And so he's going to start focusing on writing to, addressing the people of New York through several New York newspapers. That is why when you open your Federalist Papers and you start to read, beginning with number one, and every number, every one of the 85 essays begins to the people of New York, because these were newspaper articles meant for the people of New York. Later, Hamilton would get the idea. First, he flirted with the idea of really kind of a something resembling what eventually became a syndication service. He thought, hey, we're producing all these essays. Why limit it to these New York newspapers? Why not send these essays out to other newspapers in other states? And so he tried that with very limited success. Only a few newspapers outside of New York picked this series up. But then he got the idea, why not publish it in the form of a book? And he published volume one the next spring. He starts writing these in October of 1787, right? Just a few weeks after the Constitutional Convention wraps up in September. And then in October, he starts writing Federalist Papers. And go fast forward to the next spring, March of 1788 is when he has the first volume published in book form, which will consist of numbers 1 through 36. And then a couple months after that, May, I believe, 1788, volume 2 is published. So then that's the remaining numbers 37 through 85. Now, of these, the authors here, we should say a few words about the authors. I spent quite a bit of time talking about this Monday evening. I'll just kind of summarize here, because you can go pick up all kinds of biographies on the three authors of the Federalist Papers if you're interested. John Jay, James Madison, and Alexander Hamilton. I'm going to say very little about Jay and Madison. I'll say a little bit more about Hamilton. So John Jay was the first one Hamilton enlisted as a partner. And Jay was a big deal. He was a big deal. He was governor of New York. He was, of course, he would become the first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. He was a well-respected, widely known, influential man of the law and judge and statesman. And he was a man of bad health all the way from the time of his childhood. He never really was a healthy, vigorous person, and he was sick, and so he didn't last very long. He ended up writing five essays out of the 85 that make up the Federalist Papers. He doesn't last very long. All of his contributions are early in the book. In terms of those numbers, it boils down basically to Jay writes five, Madison writes about 30, Hamilton writes about 50, the bulk of them. And there's 85 total. So 50 for Hamilton, 30 for Madison, 5 for John Jay. And John Jay was one of these guys. He was born into a wealthy family. I mean, at one point he has, a private tutor when he's young. I mean, John Jay's the kind of person born with, you know, that old phrase, born with a silver spoon in his mouth. That sort of was John Jay. I mean, you kind of expect, you when you look at his early biography, you sort of expect John Jay to do something impressive. Same with James Madison. You know, James Madison was born into a wealthy Virginia plantation family. I mean, he has private teachers and tutors and, right, attends the best schools. And so you kind of expect much from James Madison. Of the three, then this is my opinion. My opinion of the three, Hamilton is far away the most interesting, most fascinating. I sometimes joke with people that I have a man crush on Hamilton. And what I mean by that, his story is just fantastic. It's so gripping. It's so hard not to feel this connection with Hamilton when you learn about his life. And that's not to say that I agree with Hamilton and everything. I don't. And there were certainly big policy decisions he made where I actually strongly disagree with him. But his life story, I mean, this is a guy, Alexander Hamilton, who was just born into nothing. By the way, for those of you, I did a little seminar, a little public presentation on Hamilton 5-6 years ago. And it was great. It was a cold February night. I remember we packed an auditorium. It just shocked me that how many people wanted to show up and learn about Alexander Hamilton. But we had a great time. And this was long before, you know, there was a Broadway musical or anything. I mean, that's really popular now. But it's worth mentioning, if you have not checked into Ron Chernow's biography of Hamilton, his last name is Chernow, C-H-E-R-N-O-W, I believe, Ron Chernow. That is the biography upon which the Broadway musical is based. And if you've not read it, it's hard for me to encourage it sufficiently. I mean, it's wonderful. I highly, highly encourage you to go check out Ron Chernow's biography. It is, in my opinion, one of the most beautiful political biographies ever written on Hamilton. And what you learn in that biography is Hamilton was a guy just born into squalor and poverty. I mean, it was his mother had, I mean, all kinds of problems, men in and out of her life. Hamilton never knew his father. His father was never around. In fact, it was unclear exactly who was Hamilton's father. And then he and his mom both contract, I don't remember exactly the nature of it, but some terrible sickness. It almost killed Hamilton. This is when he's like 8 or 9 years old. I mean, he's a little kid. He's a little boy. He almost dies, and his mom does. I mean, they're both lying in bed with, you know, 106-degree fevers, and he watches his mom die in this pool of sweat and blood and mucus, and it's terrible. And then this is on a little island in the West Indies, and then he gets bounced around from orphanage to orphanage. I mean, he has nothing. He has no family. He has no support system. Young Hamilton, I mean, it's kind of surprising that he survived childhood, honestly. I mean, everything was lined up against this kid. Everything.